I'm Jason Van Medding.
And I'm Ksenia Chmutina.
Welcome to Disasters Deconstructed podcast.
How's things?
Good. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm a bit warm because I turned my AC off here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I don't have that problem. It's, you know, summer never came to the UK this year.
That's a pity.
I know.
I remember the feeling.
Right, when you wait and wait and people are saying, oh, it's going to be nice in July. Oh, it's going to be nice in August. Oh, it's going to be nice in September. And then it's winter again.
Oh, so depressing.
Today we are going to talk about capacity. Well, in fact, today and next week we're going to talk about capacity. And this is a follow-up to the mini-series Ingredients of Disasters, which I hope you've all enjoyed as much as we did. Mm. So if you remember, we've talked about natural hazards, we unpacked the idea of vulnerability, and also last week we talked to Lee Bosher about exposure.
Yeah, and so for the next 2 weeks, we are going to share a discussion we had with JC Gaillard from University of Auckland. And he joined us a while ago to record some discussions about capacities and capacity. And it's really fascinating, and we look forward to sharing this with you guys over the next 2 weeks.
Yes, and I mean, there is a lot to unpack when we talk about capacity. Oh, and actually, talking of episode, that was probably the most internationally recorded episode we had, wasn't it? We were all kind of in different places from where we usually are.
Well, and that gives me a good setup to mention that the sound quality is not what I would hope for this episode or the next two episodes, because we were in different locations with our travel microphones and so on. And so it's a little bit less than we would usually aim for. I mean, in general, I'm no sound engineer and I'm doing my best, but every week I'm like, oh, how do I get rid of these like little clicks? Last week it was like the clicking of my mouse because we had some difference between the sound level from my side and your side with Lee. I was like trying to eliminate my clicks, but it was impossible because I had to change the sound levels and it was picking up my mouse. So annoying, eh?
I know, but I mean, our weekly drama, we should probably, you know, talking about disasters and disaster risk management, I think you and I are pretty rubbish at managing disasters.
Well, Ksenia is referring to the fact that I got locked out of my office while we were recording an episode. Yeah. Funny chain of events, but I just disappeared from a recording, so that was embarrassing.
Whilst Jason was trying to get himself back in the office on a weekend, I basically thought that he's dead.
Sorry.
But yeah, quite entertaining, never mind. And the week before, I couldn't hear anything because 15 minutes later, I realized that I didn't plug my headphones in.
Oh, is that what happened?
Right, see, we're so good at this.
Wow, we should have an episode about our disastrous podcasting.
That's right, disastrous podcasting, that's right. Maybe we should develop some capacity, or capacities, in fact.
I agree. In that vein, let's listen to our conversation with JC.
Enjoy. So capacity contains critical meaning that relates to our understanding of communities. But not many people, not many researchers, not many journalists actually talk about capacity.
Joining us for the discussion today, we have Dr. JC Gaillard. JC is a geographer by training, and he's a researcher and practitioner working with communities, agencies, and local governments. His work focuses broadly on reducing disaster risk, and for me, what he does is brings particular sensitivity to issues of vulnerability, injustice, and marginalization. So thanks for being with us, JC.
Thank you, Jason and Ksenia. Thanks for inviting me.
Right, so I'll start. Not many academics discuss capacity. Not many academics write about capacity. You know, how did you end up focusing on capacity so much and sort of trying to bring it into light?
Maybe we should clarify whether we talk about capacity singular or capacity plural. I tend to use the plural, and I can explain why afterwards. And I think both could convey different meanings and different, or may have different implications in terms of practice. I think the concept came up late in the 1980s, or it was formalized back then, especially in Anderson and Woodrow's seminal book, Rising from the Ashes. And it was, to me, looking at it now, 30 years afterwards, a sort of pushback against the emphasis that was put on people as vulnerable, the sort of label, the stigma associated with people being vulnerable. And it was not to push back against the whole underpinning epistemology that led to vulnerability to emerge as a key concept and the whole paradigm around it. It was more just putting forward that people are not just victims, quote marks, they're not just helpless, they're not just vulnerable, and that we need to be careful in our labeling, but that people have at the same time their resources, their skills, their different forms of knowledge they use and pull together to actually do things in facing disasters and hazards and disasters. And these are usually their first toolbox in facing those threats.
Do you think, JC, it strikes me that many people that talk about vulnerability are approaching it from a understanding of lack and weakness instead of one of looking at strengths. So like in community development, you have asset-based community development and strength-based approaches. Do you think there's like a real difference in ideologies when people come to look at vulnerability and capacity?
That's an interesting question. It's interesting how the concept of capacity slash ease hasn't gained much traction amongst academics. And no one has put much thinking about it. I mean, it's all gone towards resilience, for the better or the worse, I'm not sure. And whether capacities mirror the same thing as resilience is another question we can debate after. I don't think it's the same to me, but capacities are the resources people have hasn't been conceptualized, so it's somehow hard to answer the question from a theoretical perspective. It's been taken for granted by practitioners, and it emerged largely from a practitioner's perspective. And that's true, I think, even though for practitioners, and people tend to focus on the lack of on vulnerability, because that justifies external intervention. That patronizes the work of many organizations.
Yeah, and do you think, you know, could it be because you said that this capacity is about resources that people have, is that many don't recognize capacity because they do not recognize these resources as resources? You know, they're not about the money resources, right? It's not about kind of financial and stuff, capitalist value resources, and that's why they're not seen as such.
Some are. I think it's. I think that unpacking resources, unpacking capacities, is probably as difficult as unpacking vulnerability. They could be tangible, they could be intangible, they could be local, they could relate to transnational networks. They could They could be accessible to all, they could be less accessible to others. I don't think it can be as difficult to unpack them and to identify them and to not really to use them and then talk about afterwards, because I definitely think that it's easier to enhance capacities than to reduce vulnerabilities. But from an outsider's perspective, I think it's not as easy as we may think of.
I'm really interested in, why there hasn't been more focus on people or capacities of communities or capacities of people, and why we would be so focused more on what people can't do as opposed to what they can do. And JC, you kind of spoke to this a little bit in saying that there was, perhaps vested interest in seeing communities as weak and vulnerable. What are some of those reasons why we focus on weakness rather than strengths?
I mean, obviously, if you take a practitioner's perspective, especially an international perspective, you need to justify your intervention. And I think portraying people as vulnerable is much more powerful to seek resources and to justify intervention, and I hate that word intervention, than portraying people as resourceful, skillful, and creative. And I mean, that's been very, very prominent in a few fields, and I don't want to point to particular people here, but I mean, look at how, let's say, psychologists and social workers, and I don't want to put everyone in the same basket because they are very critical social workers and very critical psychologists, but there's been this overall kind of assumption that people suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and need support from the outside, supporting them as vulnerable from a mental health perspective, just to justify patronizing somehow the intervention of social workers and psychologists. And I know many social workers and many psychologists were put off by that kind of portraying of people as vulnerable, because they actually see on the ground, especially if they are local social workers or local psychologists, then the views of outsiders is definitely not what they observe in the field.
So JC, would you say like that this is kind of what, talking about these things and thinking about them critically is a bit of a challenge to the idea of charity in general and aid?
Probably is, and it's not a new debate. I mean, it's been around for 40 years, probably more than. But I think if the concept of capacity hasn't got as much traction as vulnerability, it's largely the case.
Yeah, it seems to me like we see this all the time in the way that charity. Or development campaigns, are framed, and the way that the agencies seek funding for their programs is usually based on a understanding of the subject group as vulnerable and weak, right?
Mm. And it's a paradox, I think, because, again, I'm deeply convinced that it's much easier to enhance capacities than to reduce vulnerability, especially at the level of grounded practitioners like NGOs or local government agencies. I mean, I'm always concerned and puzzled when I do some work for local, for NGOs, let's say NGOs in general, in a particular village, and the staff at the start of the training, at the start of the week, for example, will tell people, okay, at the end of the week, you will be less vulnerable. Good luck. Good luck. What you can do is mostly enhance capacities. This is much more realistic in terms of a goal. Thank you. you want to emphasize capacities, you can't be normative. You have to build on what's available locally, and you want to foster creativity and people's ability to cope organically with whatever threat they deal with. And it's a very difficult environment to impose the very normative discourse or discourses of DRR. So it's much easier to channel, to vehicle the normative approach of DRR we have through emphasizing vulnerability.
You know, it's like with all these buzzwords that we've been discussing, so vulnerability, resilience, and capacity, it seems to me like very often all of this is kind of seen as an endpoint. Okay, you know, we've built our capacity, or we've reduced your vulnerability, right? We are now resilient. So it seems like somehow it's not seen as a process, which, you know, of course it is. So is there a danger that if we focus too much on a capacity, we will end up with a discourse that we now have a lot with this community resilience? So okay, you know, now you have your capacity, we don't need to support you any longer, kind of, you know, and you're on your own to deal with whatever comes your way.
No, because vulnerability and capacities are not the two ends of the same spectrum, and you can be very vulnerable with a lot of capacities. You can be very vulnerable with limited capacities. You can be less vulnerable with few capacities or with more capacities. So it's not because you're working on your capacities, you're enhancing your capacities, that you're doing anything to address the root causes of vulnerabilities, and you're gonna still have disasters if you only rely on capacities. And I think that's a clear distinction we have to make. And capacities are not the flip side of vulnerability. These are two different things.
Yeah.
And so when I put the emphasis on capacities, and I tell that, I mean, NGOs and practitioners should first build on capacities. It's not to undermine the importance of addressing vulnerability. My concern is that addressing vulnerability is not really a task for these practitioners. Addressing vulnerability requires those with power to step in, requires those with power to grant access to resources to those who lack this access in the first place. So it's a different set of actors.
Those focusing on a DRR discourse, or those focusing on a resilience discourse, often, or even a capacity discourse, can they could neglect to look at the structural causes of vulnerability, right?
Yes, absolutely. And there's this disconnect in the DR discourse between its ideological or ontological kind of background and what's being done in practice at the moment, which is very normative and which is very different from what people have or thought for us 40, 50 years ago. So I think this disconnect is one of the reasons why we struggle to actually fully capture capacities within the normative vulnerability focused DRR, but vulnerability in a sense which is corrupt somehow. It's not vulnerability as the three of us think of, I think, in most instances. It's emptied of its political essence. It's emptied of its advocacy essence. It's been normalized, which is a disconnect, and I think the discourse on capacities is leading towards that, especially towards especially due to the rolling out of VCAs or vulnerabilities and capacities analysis, which are taken for granted now as something which is okay, one tool or one framework we need to stuck into all our community base, blah blah blah, and I don't like the word community, but this is something it's taken from a project management perspective. So we need to fill in all these boxes in the predefined matrices, whether they make sense locally or not, whether we have two genders. If Anderson and Woodrow 30 years ago suggested in their book a matrix with male and female, it's not that we have to use male and female everywhere, because we know in many places gender is not looked as a binary thing, but because it's like this in many manuals, it's rolled out as granted. It's something we have to do, because to comply with our requirements, our donors' requirements, we have to do it. So we're going towards this normative, normalized approach of capacities amongst practitioners, which is a danger. Until we don't change the whole, or we don't manage to get more room to foster downward accountability in our DR initiatives, to make it more flexible, to make it more context specific, we won't get anywhere. And we know it's a challenge.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask, a little bit about some of the research that you've done on capacities, JC, and can you tell us, maybe just give us a bit of context about how you have looked at this in the field, and maybe some insight into the kind of methodology you use to try to ensure that your work is culturally sensitive?
I don't think there's anything new, anything groundbreaking in what we've tried to publish recently on capacities. And I think we've in our thinking, in our realization of the importance of the context, it's been exactly the same process as the one you can read in Anderson and Woodrow's books. I mean, it's basically a realization by doing practical work that people are not helpless, and then addressing vulnerability again at the local level is very, very difficult. So if you want to do something meaningful, you have to find another path, and that path is just to build on what people usually do, and pool these resources, skills, knowledge together, make sure that everyone at the local level has access to this, which may be an issue because you may have to challenge local culture, and we can talk about it afterwards. But this is something that came out of practice more than research following very rational methodologies or research processes. And it's more an organic realization by doing practical work, I think. And I think if we want to step back a bit and try to put some more academic thinking about it, which is what we've tried to do over the past few years, this is how we've come to think that, it's actually very difficult to address vulnerability, because the root causes of vulnerability are largely exogenous, while capacities are largely endogenous. Mm-hmm. Endogenous, not indigenous. They are organic. People hold them. So it's obviously much easier to enhance something you have than address something you don't control. But it's sports training, right? You always tend to emphasize your strength rather than work on your weaknesses, because your weaknesses will always be your weaknesses, whatever you do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's always easier to enhance your strength. And this is what capacities are all about, I think. The tricky bit, because organic, endogenous, doesn't mean that they are necessarily local. And this is something we struggled with for a long time, and this is something that challenges the very concept of capacity of community, in the sense of many practitioners. Capacities can be transnational. The remittances sent back home by migrants are part of people's capacities. People hold them. People have those networks. They are existing. It's obviously difficult to actually work with these, because when you do work at the local level, from a practitioner's perspective again, it's very difficult to talk to the migrants at the same time and factor the migrants in the picture, because you have migrants scattered all around the world. So it's challenging. But I would still say that these are endogenous resources. They're social networks. So there's a distinction we need to make here between endogenous and local. To me, they are two different things. A few other things, like, I mean, capacities can be individual, and they can be collective. So people pool these capacities together often through these social networks. So you have your own knowledge, your own skills, but at the same time, you share them, you pool them with those of your neighbors, of your relative, of your kin. So that's why it's very difficult to actually for an outsider, for an insider, it's obviously very. I mean, it's embedded, so it's obvious. But for an outsider, it's very, very difficult to tease these out. And there are many other dimensions we can talk about, but this is still very organic, very endogenous. These are very much grounded in people's everyday life. The capacities people display, if display is the right word, in time of hardship or in facing hazards and facing disasters are seldom things that come out of the blue. Usually extend your everyday skills, everyday knowledge to the time of hardship. I mean, if you're a carpenter in everyday life, you may use these skills to rebuild. But if you're not a carpenter in everyday life, you won't become a carpenter in time of disasters. If you know how to swim, or if you know how to, I'm not sure, to navigate a boat offshore, you will use these skills in time of disasters, and you won't improvise them. If you know how to do CPR, you know it. You won't improvise doing CPR post-disaster, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, you said that it's the kind of the local skills, or the culture very often that is sort of ingrained in the capacities. But I guess the problem is that the capacities are then researched not by local people who understand, you know, those little intricacies. And maybe that's why the external researchers just simply don't notice them. I don't know. Is that...
Yeah, it could be. I mean, could be. Yeah, I think it's as difficult as for vulnerability.
Do you see a big difference when you work in different contexts?
I think it's very context specific. It's very difficult to make conclusions or take some lessons out of the context. Mm. One thing related to culture that matters, I think. And that takes us back to the discussion on vulnerability as well, is that, as I said, enhancing capacities probably often or sometimes requires to challenge norms, values, because, I mean, take local knowledge, for example. It could be a symbol of privilege, right? It's not everyone that has the same knowledge within a particular neighborhood, particular village, and holding that knowledge may be a privilege, which is that of a chief, that of someone who has power, right? So if you want to make that knowledge shared across your village or your neighborhood, then you may need to challenge the power of the chief, for example. So that's a big question mark to me. I mean, who are we outsider to suggest that? There's a cultural, there's an ethical issue there.
So this was the first part of the two episodes about capacity with JC Gaillard.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting discussion so far, and we hope that you will all tune in again next week to hear the rest of our chat with JC. And just to remind you again that you can download Disasters Deconstructed wherever you get your podcasts every Monday. And don't forget to follow us and tweet us at DisastersDecon and check us out on Instagram. You've been listening to Disasters Deconstructed podcast. I'm Jason Von Medi.
And I'm Ksenia Chmutina.
See you next time.
Bye.